Good morning, Brother John.
Good morning, Jerry.
So, anywho, we got some interesting stuff today.
Sure do.
Yeah.
Hey, I want to remind you, make sure to call your brother today. It's his birthday. Okay.
No, I got that on my calendar.
I got a big sign right in front of me. Let me know. So.
Did you really?
Oh, this last night, I mean, I just put in a big magic marker. Brother's B-Day.
Well, you know it is. Jeffrey, how old's Jeff now? God damn, he's 6 years younger than me.
1954. So yeah. You do the math. I can't do it without a calculator, and I left mine in the office.
Oh, geez. So. I know the feeling. So, yeah, 54. So, well, he's getting up there.
Yeah, he's approaching
64?
Yeah, 64. 63.
Really? That's it?
Yeah, figure 63 plus 54 gives you 2017. Yeah.
Yeah, you're right about that. Okay. Yeah. All right. So, wow, we can still add and subtract.
Well, together, I think we are able to work it out, but one of us alone, I don't know.
Well, happy birthday, Jeff.
Yes. Little shout out to our bro.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, one of these days we'll have him on the show when we're all together in the same place at the same time. It'll be fun. Together again.
Yes.
So, anywho, hey, let's talk about hurricanes a little bit. You want to? And waffles.
Yeah, waffles. Man, you know, I haven't had breakfast yet, so let's keep it light.
Oh, man.
Hey, by the way, speaking of breakfast, you know, what the hell? I go over to the original pancake house the other day. I mean,
now you're torturing me.
It's like I walk in, and where they say, do they say hi? No. They say, where's your brother? Where's your brother? And then I say, well, he took a plane back down to Austin. And they say, well, did he make it home okay? Yeah. Well, how's he doing? He's okay. And of course, when I sit down, what do they say to me? Eat your pancakes. Yes, Mom, I will. Okay.
Jeez. Yeah. You're getting like the Rodney Dangerfield of the Daniels Brothers. Oh,
God bless. I can't believe how popular you are up here. I mean, I thought Axrod was the David Axrod was the most popular podcaster up here. But on the Gold Coast, if you come back up here, you're going to probably be approaching his popularity.
Oh, my God.
I mean, you better be careful. I mean, it's scary up here.
How did this happen, I wonder? Well, we'll have to ponder that at another time. But,
yeah, but okay. I'm recovering a little bit, okay?
Oh, what a bruising.
Yes.
Well,
so
anyway,
back to the old Waffle House.
Yeah, but big shout out to my buds here. Up there. My buds up there on the Gold Coast, down on the Loop, Old Town. I made lots of friends up there. It was fun.
Yeah, good time.
Yeah. So, any case, let's this Waffle House thing. You know, this is we've been talking about this. It seems like for 3 weeks. When hurricane season comes along, we ran into this when we were talking about baseball, football rather, because there's like a major thing. There's certain teams down in the Georgia area who and down there who just are crazy about this Waffle House thing, and I got real curious about it. You got real curious about it, so I don't know what to make of it. I went there. Okay, so Mary Jane and I went there yesterday, and I don't know, John. I'm trying to find out what's so spectacular about either the food, the ambiance, anything. And the only thing that I came up with is these people are in their own little world. There's no Wi-Fi. There's like, you know, eat your pancakes. It is a little bit like that.
Yeah.
You know, they want to get you in and out of there pretty quick. The menu itself is the food that we had to eat was excellent. I mean, it was very good.
And how is the coffee? That's the critical thing.
Well, here's the deal. The coffee. You know, and we have some pretty good calibrations on this. There's first sip, second sip, third sip, second cup, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
I would say, you know, the big thing I look for on the first sip is this so freaking bitter that, you know, I'm going to need to doctor this somehow?
Yeah.
It wasn't. It was not.
Good.
Okay. So I had black coffee the whole time I was there. Mary Jane doctored hers, and she liked it just fine. She had like 2 cups of it, and, you know, I had 2 cups also. And the food and the service and all that stuff was excellent. I got no complaints, but I would have to say, as an eating place, there's nothing terribly remarkable about it. you know, and this was an Austin flavor of it. And, you know, the Waffle House we ate at was not always a Waffle House Waffle House. It was the Longhorns Waffle House first. So there's that.
Well, I would say just kind of taking a look historically, you mentioned the football phenomena in terms of Waffle House. I mean, it goes back to the Carolina Panthers when they made it, as they marched into the Super Bowl. It seems like the players, not necessarily as a group, but it just seemed like they, as individuals, gravitated to the various Waffle Houses that were located, you know, near where they lived. And so as a result, got a little notoriety. You know, of course, this franchise starts back in the mid-50s, but what it does have is comparable to what you ran into, and that is that they have done a pretty good job of increasing through acquisition of other smaller franchises that they can easily convert into their own brand. And
right.
That sounds like what they've done there. I also like a place that hustles and bustles. It isn't like you don't feel consciously like you are eating faster, but it's just the pace of the place kind of puts you in that mood. And before you know it, well, gee, I'm done with my meal. Well, where's my check? You know, it's the way these places kind of work. So yeah, I was, you know, I took a look at the menu. I guess I could call myself a breakfast snob.
With the Pancake House in your hip pocket, I think so.
Yeah,
I've never been to a breakfast place like that.
And so it's kind of funny because the Pancake House he's referring to, I mean, they're as well known for their egg entrees as they are for their pancakes. And you always get pancakes on the side. In other words, you don't have to eat. Do you want toast or you want pancakes? And of course, I take the pancakes. The other thing about the Waffle House is that I'm a waffle snob, I find out.
Yeah, you are. You're
because
a Belgian boy,
I go for the Belgian thicker waffle. And the Waffle House offers a large waffle, but it's the shallow waffle. It's the one you typically see. It's sort of like a gigantic version of the one you would see if you went to the grocery store and bought an Eggo and put it in your toaster. This is just a big version of it. What it boils down to.
These down here, you know, we're in the South and we're in Austin and we're in Texas and all that stuff. Down here, it's kind of a dividing line with the waffles. And the only places down here that serve Belgian waffles are pretty hoity-toity places, you know, like big hotels downtown or something like that. But, you know, the South Austin, which is kind of the area we live in, very, very working class. And they go, Belgian waffles, you know, they get kind of a sick look on their face. What? You know? So, man, I'll tell you, it would be an adjustment.
You were talking, you know, as you mentioned, in terms of this place, I think that if you take a look at the second line item here, it's the steak and eggs. And I think that's shown by your description of the condiments,
condiments
that you got on there. What did you say?
There are four different condiments for steaks. There's Lean Perrin, Heinz 57, which you don't see very often, actually.
Yeah.
A1, and did I say Lean Perrin?
No, you didn't. Lean Perrin's the other one.
Yeah, Lean Perrin. So that's a lot of stuff for steaks. And they only had one thing for eggs, which was the Tabasco sauce. They didn't have Cholula sauce. And I tried the Tabasco sauce, and I have to say, it's like at least watered down 50%.
Your taste buds are probably burned out. Jeez, you couldn't.
Well, no. I'm talking consistency. Good try. Oh, okay. Good try. I'm talking about consistency. I expect my Tabasco sauce to kind of bead a little bit when you put it on your eggs, but this stuff just ran. Yeah.
Hey, that coffee cup that they got. Did you steal that cup, by the way? Did you get one out of there?
I wanted to. John, this coffee cup's a weapon. We could use it. You know, if we get attacked or something, because. It's not a big cup. It's about the size of a European cup.
Mm-hmm.
And European cups for coffee are smaller. You know, they're like a very large espresso cup, kind of. But these things were about that size. They're just a teeny bit larger than a European cup. But the thickness of the cup, the wall, I don't know what else to call it, the walls of the cup, would you call it that? You know,
yeah.
The thickness. It is unbelievably thick. It's like a half inch at least. Mm. And the thing, when you lift it up, you're going, holy cow, is this thing made out of lead? I mean, it's very heavy. And it's well done. It looks good. It's a good-looking cup.
Hey, can you buy the cup? And,
you know, I didn't even look. I was so stunned.
Because you can buy the cups at the Pancake House. And they're outrageously priced.
Well, okay, we got to revisit on this thing, because I would go back just to find out about the cup. And we only have two Waffle Houses in Austin. We don't have like 50 of them like they have in Houston. No, we just got the one, or two rather.
You're pretty close. I was just looking at the article I read about FEMA and the Waffle House, and it says they've got 40 of them in Houston. So you're pretty close.
Wow. I mean, well, if you count the outlying areas, I'm sure it's over 50.
Yeah.
It's sprawling. Well, so anyway, let's tie this into, we kind of got the connection with sports, you know, that it's kind of a Disneyland thing for some of these Southern teams where a guy will get, I'm going to the Waffle House, you know, at the end of a win or something. But other than that, the sports connection is somewhat tenuous. But the real connection is, of course, the Hurricane Index, which needs help. I think we'd agree, wouldn't you say?
I would say. I think what we ran into was this. We were taking a look at the disaster, Hurricane Irma. Noted that first thing is you have to understand that the Waffle Houses originated in Georgia, and their location is primarily south, and there's a lot of them in Florida. There's a lot of them along the Gulf Coast, and there's a lot of them in Texas. In fact, the closest one to me here in Chicago is 160 miles away. I was going to make a site visit, but I finally said, I got to put the white flag up. I can't go 300 miles, back and forth to one of them.
Yeah.
But as you go further south, we've got a couple of them in our hometown, St. Louis. So bottom line is that there's a lot of them in the area that's covered by the hurricane. So what FEMA has done in the past is it's kind of looked at the other thing about a Waffle House is it is a 24-hour restaurant. And I'll tell you, considering its name, that is a challenge. Because,
yes,
I mean, when you say Waffle House, do you think dinner?
No.
No, you don't. I mean, so they've done a good job of being able to kind of put another menu together to have for lunch and dinner. So FEMA, what they've done is they've noticed that that since they're 24-hour places to eat, that Waffle House is
not just 24, 365 days a year.
Yeah, good point.
Okay,
so FEMA has noticed that that the Waffle House prides itself in the fact that it will remain open, or if it does get damaged, it will quickly reopen, to the point that they don't even wait to become 100% in terms of their menu. If they could offer 50% of their menu, they're going to open on a limited basis in terms of what they can offer their customers. So as a result, what has happened is that they have what's called the Waffle House Index that's used by FEMA. And if they look at it and they say, this place is really hurting, there is no white Waffle Houses open or
red. That's red.
And then what's the next one, Jerry?
The next one's yellow, and it's yellow because they have a limited menu. That's what, and then if it's open, green. So that's how they roll. And there's a reason for this. They have a hurricane protocol within those areas that are near hurricanes and really bad weather and stuff. And I wouldn't be surprised, to tell you the truth, if all of them are aware of the protocol. Now, the part of the protocol that really pertains to hurricanes and tornadoes and what have you is they actually have plywood on hand, plywood to put over the windows.
Mm-hmm.
So they're ready. They're ready. They can close and they can open probably faster than any eating place in the United States, I would say. And that's whether the index. That's why there's a Waffle House Index, is because these guys, there's the smallest amount of distance and time between opening, closing, limited menu, full menu, all that stuff. They are machines. They're robots. I was in there. You can tell these guys do this all the time. They don't look rushed. They don't look hurried. They don't look harried. They just look like boom, 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 boom. And they just do it. And boy, they're pretty good at it, I have to say. They knock out the food quickly. And I can just imagine what they do with these hurricanes, getting the plywood up, getting this done, preparing for water damage. you know, they've got it all. They've got a punch list here, and they walk down it, walk back up it, and they're open, they're closed. And so
When FEMA takes a look at which companies are there to probably assist them, support them, whatever, I ran into the list of four of them. I ran into Walmart,
yep,
Lowe's, Home Depot, and Waffle House. And I said, which of these doesn't make any sense? I thought, God, plus, how did Waffle House get on that list? And now we know.
Now we know the story. But the food itself, I mean, that's the ultimate comfort food, breakfast. A lot of people, they've had a bad day. We're just going to have breakfast for dinner. You know, at home, you do that. So if you can't cook at home, what are you going to do?
Waffle House.
Sounds like a Waffle House event. So
yes.
Let's hear it for the Waffle House. You know, their ordinariness is distracting. What's really the story is they got these protocols, man. And I'm pretty impressed. Show you how sick I am. I would be one of these. I wouldn't be a storm watcher, John. I'd be a Waffle House.
You're bad.
I know. Terrible, isn't it?
Oh, dear. Oh, well.
Yeah.
So, you know, maybe we ought to go right into the hurricane. I don't mean physically.
Yeah.
And Irma, talk about that, and then we can finish up with our film. How does that sound?
I can't wait.
Boy, I'll tell you, the thing about this hurricane is that as we took a look at it, it's like...
This touched my brother's life, by the way, you guys.
Yeah, I timeshare. I'm a baseball nut, which means that since I go to spring training. I'm a baseball aficionado. How does that sound?
Yeah, okay. Okay, very, very, very classy.
So, ever, I guess, since 1977, I've been going to Florida on the Gulf side. And I've bounced back and forth. I started going to, well, Sarasota's where I kind of hang. And I'm on Siesta Key, which is out, it's out even hanging further into the Gulf when it comes to that. So I kind of had a more than a passing interest in the hurricane. So I was watching it pretty carefully. And I think the thing about this hurricane that's mind-boggling is that as much as we have all this great technology in terms of weather, this hurricane seem to challenge the weather forecasters to some extent because of its path. And that path, all of a sudden we're evacuating Miami. I mean, 75 is like a parking lot as they try to get out of Miami. And then all of a sudden we're told as it's approaching that, by the way, it's going to be going rather than up the East Coast, it's going to be going up the West Coast.
Yep.
And sure enough, it starts up then. I thought, oh dear, West Coast, Gulf side, that's me. And it bounces up to Fort Myers. It hits Fort Myers pretty heavy. And then Fort Myers is about 90 miles south of Sarasota, probably 125 miles, 30 miles south of Tampa, the Tampa Bay area. And I thought, oh, I'm going to get it full blunt. Full force is going to go into Sarasota.
Yep.
And all of a sudden, it takes a path inward. And it's heading towards Orlando. And the other thing about it was that the severity of the storm, which was predicted, didn't come to be. Now, we're away from Florida. So we can talk about how the severity is less as these poor people are suffering from lack of power, a lot of water. But when you take a look at it in terms of building damage, and things such as that, this hurricane wasn't as bad as the ultimate disaster that was being described to us by the Weather Channel with a Category 5 that eventually, as it bounced its way up to Tampa Bay, by the time it got to, you know, it kind of goes a little bit peripherally over that. It's a Category 1.
Right.
So I think that it requires I think this is going to be a good hurricane for the weather people to take a look at and see what happened and how that's going to feed into their database as they look forward to it. Unfortunately, you know, we know what's happening because of the weather and the warm Gulf and the warm waters that are surrounding Florida. It's going to be a candidate for hurricanes in the future with more regularity, with more frequency.
Yep.
So having this ability to predict is going to be very, very important in the future.
Not just prediction, but, you know, I think how they talk about the hurricanes, it's very, very, it's pretty crude, really. I think a lot of these measurements they took were done, you know, decades ago, and they need new metrics is the point. Even with Hurricane Harvey, you know, it's very, let's say Category 5. Okay, well, that gets everybody's attention. But the real disaster that was Hurricane Harvey was how badly it stalled out and how much water it dumped.
Right.
And so, and these are, this is a, and John just spoke about the temperature, water temperature. The Gulf is a lot warmer than it used to be. And so this is changing the whole dynamic of what a hurricane is and what the danger is that it represents. There are things like storm surge and all these little nuances that they talk about, but hardly anyone understands what a surge is. And right, John?
I took a look at the storm surge, and here's the thing that kind of baffled me as I heard them talk about it on the TV. They said, "Well, the hurricane went through, but the storm surge." It almost made it sound like the storm surge was an event that was going to take place after the hurricane came in. When in effect, storm surge, as you take a look at it, represents the difference in the water level that we would normally have coming onto the coast, as we, you know, the border, the coastlines of Florida, and what the water level will be during the hurricane. Now, what happens is that as the hurricane spins around and as it's out in the deep ocean, storm surge isn't a problem because it's the water's deep enough that it'll you know, be able to take it. But as you get closer and you get to shallow waters, it forces the water onto the coast and thereby makes it go further inland and also at these higher levels. But when you talk storm surge, you also have to take in consideration the fact that you got tide. So tide could also increase and decrease. So when you have it, can make a big difference. Now, the reason that storm surge is something that's after the fact, it's happening during the hurricane. But the difference is that the storm surge is going to stay while the wind continues on its merry way beyond, you know, the area. So you're going to get less wind, but you're going to get rain, which is going to also add to the storm surge. And that's going to stay there. So the flooding, for example, I was telling Jerry that this morning, I just happened to run into a YouTube video of my actual timeshare on Siesta Key. And what I noticed is this nice, sunny, bright little wind is the water on the streets that make it practically impossible to get to it. But other than that, you see a little bit of damage. My building looks fine. So I got kind of a sense of relief as I kind of took a look at it this morning.
And you almost drove to your condo on a YouTube video.
Yeah, I could. I mean, it was like I was going right down the little road. If you go, Siesta Key has got a bridge you go over, then you got a main thoroughfare called Midnight Pass Road, and then off that is this little road that's there. Kalini Beach is the name of mine, and I couldn't believe it. It's like I'm going down this road 2 minutes into this eight minute YouTube video, so that was pretty impressive. So the other thing though that I think that makes this a little bit more dicey in terms of prediction is that when you take a look at what happens with most hurricanes is they'll hit the coast and then what they'll do is they will then bounce back into the ocean. And of course, when it's in the ocean, there's no damage. With this one, what we have going on, it bounces a little bit out onto the ocean, but it's mostly bouncing in the state of Florida. If you're on land, and you're going, obviously, and then you're going back and forth between, I mean, we have Tampa Bay mentioned as an area that had a lot of water. And then all of a sudden you hear about Jacksonville. Hey, we're talking two sides of Florida. That shows you that the bandwidth, I mean, the width of this hurricane has not only wide, but it also takes over the whole state of Florida.
So yeah, it goes right across.
It just goes, yeah. It. So a lot of times that's you big. See hurricanes are going to be heading north, but this one went directly north, while a lot of times hurricanes will just go like northwest, which means that they're bouncing more onto the coast and then coming off. Because what happens here is that the land offers a hindrance to it, which decreases the wind.
So slows it down.
So slows it down. And that's the other thing that I found out when I was doing a little research, that in terms of the severity, we were fortunately, Cuba was to our benefit, because Cuba got hit pretty hard, but that decreased it. And what the predictors, the weather forecasters were going to say about the hurricane was that, well, it'll pick up again after it hits Cuba and go across water. But, you know, there's not a lot of water between Cuba and the Florida.
90 miles. 90 yeah. miles.
So as a result, it didn't pick up as much as they expected. So by the time it hit Florida, it wasn't as severe a storm as they thought it was going to be. It wasn't that Category 5. It was more, you know, the 3, the 4, gradually getting down as it goes across land to the 2 and the 1. But, of course, that doesn't in any way diminish the effects, the other effects of hurricanes, which is the water. It was fortunately not as bad as we had in Houston, because this tornado moved along a lot quicker, a lot faster as it made its way up Florida and headed towards Georgia.
So, hold on a second, John. I have to interrupt our regular scheduled programming with some breaking news. I'm here. I have bad Wi-Fi and bad internet in my home, so I drive out to a place like JD's Market where I am right now, and they've got free public Wi-Fi. So I'm sitting here doing the show, and as I sit here, a guy drove up to the dumpsters, John, and he fly dumped.
Fly dumping. That is a problem.
Wow. I mean, he just dumped, I would say, two good-sized garbage bags worth of his refuse into V&V Liquor's dumpster.
Well, you know, the thing is that you hear about fly dumping on an industrial basis. That's where you hear most of it in the news, about the fact, well, some company has decided to do a hit and run and go to a vacant lot and just dump a bunch of stuff. But the insidious type of fly dumping that doesn't get the news, that people don't realize what is happening out there, is there are
individuals who
they will do is they will basically decide that one of the ways they can save money is to not use their disposal service. In other words, the garbage trucks that come around, they'll cancel that service and then start putting their garbage into their cars, they keep it, you know, hidden by putting it into the trunk.
That's
and
right.
And then, of course, what they'll do is they will then go behind a strip mall or something, find a large one of those canisters or whatever you can put your garbage into. And the problem isn't that they're saving money, but the problem is that they get addicted and they get
high
off of actually dumping their garbage.
And I hate to say it, but our birthday boy brother is one of those. He's a fly dumper.
Let's be fair. He is he's a cured. He's kicked the
hat. Is he in recovery?
He's recovered from that. Okay.
Really?
Well, yeah. And you know what? I guess I'm speaking from personal experience, but my brother would pick me up. Here it is on his birthday, and we're dumping on him. No pun intended. And what he would do is he'd pick me up at the airport, you know, as I would come to visit. And he'd say to me with a gleeful sort of like smile on his face, he'd say, "I got a load. I got a load."
Yeah.
And I think,
I know.
Oh. And
yeah,
he would then,
a lot of things.
He would then go into the back and he would get this extreme pleasure out of releasing that load into the dumpster.
I know. You're right.
I'm glad that
breaking news. I'm glad I got that in there because that was pretty important.
Yes, it was.
Okay. Yeah. So where were we? We were talking about the index and storm index. We were talking about the Waffle House index. We're talking about surges, all this stuff. The point is that this is kind of important because public awareness and hurricanes and FEMA and all that stuff are important. We want the rest of the country to be keyed into what's going on in this area because there's going to be a lot of government spending. There's going to be a lot of private support that gets generated according to some of these measurements.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've got these very simplistic measurements. So what do you think, John? You think they're going to change the way they talk about hurricanes as, you know?
I think they will. You know, it's a fine line because the problem is that you want to, first thing is measurements have to become popular. People have to understand. Here I am, storm surge, and I'm scratching my head trying to figure out what that's all about. And as much as you can talk about feet to describe it, I think it's more important that first thing is you have to come up with what you consider are the key indicators, and then you've got to educate the public as to what those indicators mean. And I think so. They've got some work ahead of them, and in addition to the fact that they need to go and put the information in their database and come up with perhaps tweaking their models. Because weather, as we take a look at weather, all they're doing it's sort of like they take the all of these models, they mesh them together and come up with an average, and then are able to predict. And that's the way that they do it. So they're going to have to, I think, revisit their various things and going from there.
Yeah, I totally agree, and so. Yeah, I think we've beat that one to death, but I learned a lot of stuff about these storms over the last 2 weeks that I never thought I would. I have a client down in Houston, so I had to kind of deal with a little of it with him business-wise. He couldn't get to work anymore. Everyone at the office worked from their homes, and so it affects a lot of stuff.
Yeah, you were closer to the action down in Texas than I am. Here I am up in Illinois, and we got a few puffy clouds came over as a result of Irma, and that was about it.
Yeah. Understood. So, okay, well, cool. So, what do you think, John? You ready?
Yeah, boy, did we.
You have your T-shirt on? I think we have to have our T-shirts for this segment.
Oh, T-shirt. I think we need a T-shirt break here.
I'm just glad that, when I went to the Waffle House, for instance, I had my Bro Show T-shirt. And when I went in and told them my full disclosure, you have to tell people when you're a podcaster, I think that's only fair.
Right.
And so, it's easy. Point to the T-shirt. I'm one of these bros. Mm-hmm. I'm on the Bro Show. We're here to record a segment on a Waffle House. Okay, fine. Sit your ass down. What do you want? So it really had no effect whatsoever. But I was still glad I had my T-shirt on. And by the way, they all had tie-dye T-shirts, these women. Working at the Waffle House. Yeah, they do that on weekends. Don't ask me why. And it's an Austin thing. It's not a nationwide thing. Right? Yeah. John's been to Austin. He understands.
Yeah, but it fits Austin.
Oh, does it ever?
Yeah, it's Austin. So good. It's that, like you said, that little island there in the middle of Texas we call Austin.
Yeah, it's a sea. It's a little blue speck in the sea of red. You could say, politically speaking. Yes. And, that's the only place I've ever gone with my brother to eat dog food. Another episode of that later. But we decided, how long ago do you think we decided on this movie we're about to talk about?
I would say we've been talking about this movie probably for a good 4 or 5 months at least.
That should tell you something right there.
Jerry's bent is on science fiction. Mine is not. As a result, this movie fits more his cup of tea than mine, but I find that it's good for even just the average moviegoer who maybe isn't attracted or doesn't embrace science fiction. This is beyond that. This is not, this kind of touches it a little bit. And that's enough for me. In fact, I got a couple other movies I was thinking about that are more my type of movie that had time travel in it. And when I think back on it, but Time Traveler's Wife is the name of the movie.
Ooh. The author is Audrey Niffenegger.
Niffenegger, I like that name.
It's a great name, and she's a She's not from Chicago, but I think she got there as quick as she could.
She got there to do, I think, some of her her education, and as a result became very, very familiar with the city, particularly the area I happen to live in, which is near north, River North, it's quite often called. It's just north of the Loop. And that's where the setting for a large portion of this movie takes place, is that portion of Chicago centering around a library. And I'm a library guy. I was the controller of the Illinois Library Association. I gravitate. I love to go to libraries. And the Newberry Library happens to, when I commute from downtown in the Loop to where I live, I go right by the Newberry Library, and that's a critical part of this movie.
It's very critical.
So
I think,
why don't you give a little plot or background or
Spoiler alert, spoiler alert, spoiler alert. We're going to talk about the movie. If you haven't seen it, just turn this thing off. If you want to see it, turn it off, go watch the movie, come back. Now, the first thing we have to say is there's a movie, The Time Traveler's Wife, and there's a book, The Time Traveler's Wife. And from my standpoint, I think they did a really good job of taking this book, which had a tremendous amount of very interesting detail and nuance, and get it on the screen in a reasonable with a reasonable duration. Okay, now it could have been a 4-hour movie easily, and I would have been riveted the whole time, but I think the audience for the movie would have been diminished considerably had they done that. But they did not do that. Instead, they chose to do what they had to do to make this thing work. And it's this, for me, a very emotional movie. You know, there's, if you've ever lost anyone, whether it's a father or a mother or a child or a wife, this is your movie, because this deals with loss and how to cope with loss, and loss on a momentary basis. In other words, it's not a permanent loss, but it's nevertheless a loss. Even if you're married to a traveling salesperson, I think you would identify strongly with this movie. Because what happens? Here's what happens. Just to really blow your mind a little bit, they do a great job of starting out the movie by taking you to this idyllic kind of meadow, and there's this little girl setting up her little picnic, and she's 6 years old, and she is just the quintessential precocious 6-year old upper middle class little girl, red hair, you know, all the right clothes and stuff like that. And she's setting up her little picnic on her blanket and all this stuff. And she hears something in the bushes, oh, I guess maybe, what, 15 feet away?
Right.
And she's in a clearing, but this is kind of the edge of the clearing there, and there's bushy, bushy kind of overgrowth. She hears something, and so she immediately yells out, who is that? You know, and he identifies himself and says, greetings, Earthling. You didn't know what else to say, right? And that's pretty true, you know, because this is a different kind of human being. This guy is a time traveler. And so, but not just any time traveler. He's a time traveler who's married to that little girl when she's in her late 20s. And he's 38 years old. Hiding in the bushes. And so he already knows that's his wife. And he also knows that, you know, he thinks in his head, is this the one where I meet her? I know I meet her when she's 6 years old. And she's 6 years old, so maybe I have to go through with this. And so he does. And they work out a detente after she hits him in the face with one of her shoes and bloodies his lip. And finally, she's really something. And so he ends up just coming out with it. I'm a time traveler. And he does not identify his relationship with her, only to say that, you know, he's a friend of hers when she grows up.
I think a couple of things that with this movie is that the time traveler is it's a genetic disorder. It's a physical thing, which I think adds to me, takes away from the science fiction piece of it. And it's like this guy has got a medical issue here.
Yeah, he does. He has a condition. That's what he calls it, right?
Right. And the other thing that I find out about is that the interaction between the two parties, the husband, wife, the man, the woman, the child, the man, whatever it is yeah. that it throughout the movie you're seeing at different stages. So sometimes the wife is interacting with a younger, maybe a 28-year-old or a 20-year-old, while she's older than that. So, but it doesn't, you don't get confused by it all. It seems to make sense in terms of trying to understand what's going on the screen. So I found it to be a fairly clear movie to understand. And that helped in a long way. The other thing is that in addition to loss, I think it makes you appreciate the time, the importance of the time that you have with your,
yes.
whether it be your wife, your son,
your daughter,
your father, the importance of making that quality time. I know that as I reflected back on it, as I looked at it, I was immediately, this is the kind of movie that emotion takes over, and you're able to, by thinking emotionally about the movie, you forget and you don't let logic get in the way of emotion. Because if
Correct.
That's what you've got to do when you watch this movie to really thoroughly enjoy it. And most people can relate to that by being able to relate with their relationships with individuals. They can relate to this, to the interaction that these two individuals have. And I think that plays an important role. And of course, the other thing.
I agree.
The other thing is that you got Rachel McAdams to look at with that beautiful smile.
Oh, my God. Yeah, she's radiant. And the little girl who plays her as a six-year-old. Woo!
Yeah, you know, what I like about it is that quite often when you have children in movies, what they try to do is they try to dress up the dialogue to give them the adult kind of pithy remarks to make them sound a little bit too over the edge. They didn't do that with this kid. Her actions were as good as her dialogue in terms of putting her in sort of the space that she needs to be what I would call, just very appealing, but not over the edge cute. You know what I mean?
Agreed. Totally agreed. Now, a couple pieces here that you may be a little confused by what we're talking about here, but there is no timeline for this movie. It does not go from A to B to C to D. It's more like, you know, A.1, A.3, you know, it's jumping up and down as well as going left to right. So if you're looking at this, it's more like a sine wave or something, or something that's going up and down and in and out. And you're going all over the place, but you're not. Because emotionally, as John said, it's very steady and very constant. And that's what it is. The time travel really is just a new kind of a nuisance.
It's an inconvenience.
They're just dealing with it, you know. But what I love about time travel movies in general, and it's the same thing I love about werewolf and vampire movies, is the rules. The rules. I now John will tell you I'm not much of a rule guy. I break a lot of rules, but I do enjoy understanding them so that I can break them properly. So.
Now, fortunately, you can break them properly.
Yeah.
Not to be confused with their past.
We agreed not to talk about that.
Okay. Sorry.
All right. Okay. Yeah. So now what we're talking about is there's rules. And you don't know the rules. You're learning them as you go along. And, you know, some of them seem kind of arcane, but, you know, you just think about them for a second. And again, the emotional content is so strong, you don't think very long. Because, you know, your heartstrings are being yanked and pulled all different kinds of ways. And the real key to this thing, and I sent this to John maybe, 4 days ago, if you look at the cover of the book, that is what this movie is about. The cover of the book is so cool. It's the little girl standing, and she's in her, like, school uniform, would you say, kind of, John?
Yes.
And her little Mary Jane shoes. She's standing on that little, you know, blanket she always brings so they can have a little picnic in this clearing. And so she's standing there, and right next to her is some clothes piled on top of two shoes. And of course, these shoes are like bigger than her whole leg because she's so little. And she's just a little 6-year-old kid and she's waiting for her husband. I mean, think about that for a second.
Yes.
She knows. And she knows that's her husband. And so she's from 6 years old. This is her whole life gravitates around this guy. And just think about the pressure on him, the almost like brainwashing that takes place with her. But she is content and she has a serenity that she brings to this role at the most cataclysmic points in the story. She has this way older than her years look on her face. And the little kid does a great job of it. Rachel McAdams, of course, does a great job of it. And that's where I think people get inspired by the movie, because they're maybe going through a hard time missing somebody and they're looking at this woman dealing with it, and she does it and does a great job of it. And it's really kind of a wonderful thing if you think about it a little bit. But going through the movie, going through all these things, experiencing all these rules that they have to live within, you know, he has a rule: don't ever do anything that's not normal, because you have to do enough non-normal things. For instance, when he jumps, they call it jumping, when he jumps to another time and space, he's going to be naked.
Right.
He can't take anything with him. So there's a rule. Number one, if the weather's bad, get out of the weather. And if it's a public place, get out of view quickly. And then the second thing is what, John?
Well, hello. You're going to have to... You gotta tell me, clothes. Oh, the clothes. And here's the thing: as you were describing those shoes, I think it's important for people to understand that this demonstrates the fact that he can't travel with clothes on. So
yes.
As a result of on being unable to, that's the significance of seeing that book cover. You see those shoes there because he's going to need clothing when he jumps. And when he finishes, he's going to need that clothing. The other thing I just need to point out is if you do see the movie, make sure that you watch to the bitter end and look very carefully, because the last couple scenes of the movie include the cover of the book. They show the girl with the shoes as if it's the cover. It's mind-boggling. Okay? When you kind of connect the
important
two.
Important point. Important point. Yes. So you've got that story going on. Now he's got a mom and dad. We see his first jump when he's, I think he's 5, something like that. And, you know, and you start understanding that there's a connection between emotion. And again, we're talking about emotions again. There's a connection between emotions and jumping. A strong emotion can trigger a jump. And where he jumps is very often where his emotions go. So he very often jumps back to the moment when his mother was killed in an automobile accident.
Oh, yes.
And he lost his mother. So the crazy part about this is, because of this emotional component, at these key points when terrible things happen to a character, particularly when they happen to Henry, who is the jumper, when Henry has his first jump, who's there to help him through it? Old Henry, 38-year-old Henry is there really quick and goes right up to young Henry and says, look, with a blanket, he's all set because he knows the poor kid's going to be naked and confused. Here's a blanket. Keep this around you. I'm going to be back to help you as time goes on. I'm you when you're older. Just think about that, okay? And you are a time traveler, and this is going to happen to you many times during your life. You got to get used to it, and I will help you. Cool. Really,
yeah, we were introduced at the beginning to this is a good example of where the emotion of the movie, don't try to figure out how come young Henry can talk to older Henry
without a paradox.
Don't look for the logic, and that's what was so good about this. It never entered in to my viewing of it. The other thing to me, I think, is that's critical in terms of the relationship, and it's sort of like it's a love story that has this element where a woman has to make a decision, or if she maybe doesn't even have a choice. You don't even think about that. But you do realize that this woman is going to be married to a husband that she's, you know, she's not going to have, he's not going to have much control over when they're going to be able to get together and exactly what age or chronology. You know, he's going to be when they do get together.
Right.
So it's, she's got to make a decision as to, is this obstacle worth my feelings for this man? And she, of course, decides that it is.
Yeah. And she has to make that decision frequently.
Yes.
Because there's considerable problems. Now, one of the coolest things about this is that he jumps back in time when he's in his late 30s to first meet her. That means until he is in his, well into his 30s, he doesn't even know who she is, really. So, because of that, she's going to meet him before he meets her.
Right.
And he's going to, she's going to know who he is, and he's not going to know who she is. And of course, how is she going to contain her emotions the first time he sees her? Now, she's been briefed by older him. And saying, take it easy on me when you meet me, because I won't know you. And this will be incomprehensible to you, but it's true. Trust me. And so you got to do this. And of course, she couldn't. She couldn't. She sees him in the library. She's at the library in Newbury, where he works. Yeah. And so, you know, she's looking for some books. And the librarian who she talks to doesn't know where the books are. You're going to have to talk to the special collections. Henry, can you help this young lady? And she sees him. She hears Henry. She turns around. She sees Henry. I mean, the whole screen lights up with her face.
Yeah, her smile shows that she is meeting her husband for the first time, knowing it's her husband, but him not knowing that she is his wife.
He's just looking at her kind of like, what is the matter with this woman?
Yes.
And he has this. So she's like, she just goes for it, you know, and so she's right away, she's just, you know, she can't contain herself. And so she does finally and goes, look, I know this all sounds crazy. Let me take you to dinner and I will explain it to you. And of course, he'd be a fool to not do this.
Yeah.
Because she's beautiful.
I mean, and just, you don't need to know this woman to say yes.
Yeah. So he agrees, but you know, he's flummoxed. Definitely. Mm. And she, on the other hand, is just like Cheshire Cat. I mean, she's just, here we go. I've been waiting my whole life for this moment. So this is fantastic. And she doesn't date anyone else to speak of. You know, she, really cut her social life in pieces, you know, up until this point. All of it revolving around Henry. And Henry has been tutoring her and teaching her. And her parents kind of ignore her. And what have you. They have two other kids, and they're like tied up in their own social life, and they're socialites. And so Henry really is her husband, her lover, her tutor, her mentor. I mean, it's crazy, you know, when you think about all this stuff and what is going through her whole body. I mean, this has got to like be a full body rush for her when she first sees him. All this stuff coalesces, all these feelings, all these thoughts. And so they end up, and she tells him, your favorite place is to eat is Bow Tie, right? And he goes, yeah, it is. And so they go to this Thai place called Bow Tie, you know, Bow, French, Thai, Thai.
I like it.
And so they, it's a cool name. And of course, you know, there's all kinds of stuff that happens before he even gets there, but they get there and she's like full court press. She can't even stop. She's like going right across the table. For his face, she can't stop touching his face, and he's just like, Claire, can we just pretend that this is our first date, you know? And he's, you know, he's trying to come to grips with it, and he's moved along a good way since the library, I would say, but still, you know, he's way behind her and she's like way ahead of him, and she is she's a virgin, and this is how she knows she's going to end all that. And she knows it's that night, and, you know, he does not, but he's hoping. And all these mixed things go along, and they end up getting in the sack, and it's beautiful, and it's wonderful, and he looks over, and he's gone.
Yes. Clothes.
Nothing but his clothes laying there. And she knows he jumped. And so this goes on, you know, and we could talk for 2 days about, I could talk for 2 days about this movie, and the rest of you being bored in tears with boredom. But bottom line is, this gets they never let up on you. This is like a Green Day concert. They're at you constantly with quirks and changes. And you got to remember, everybody has a mother and a father in this thing. And he has a mother and a father, and his father's still alive and an alcoholic. He's a very cultured musician, but he can't do it anymore because he can't get over his wife. And he kind of blames his son, I think, a little bit. Mm. And he's angry with his son about this, and his son's angry with his father, and blah, blah, and they have a terrible relationship and all this stuff. And, you know, that's there too. He frequently goes back to see his mother before she dies as a 23-year-old man. And so he does this constantly because it's an emotional gravity well that he constantly falls into. So that's a component you have to remember. And so that happens with him. And then, you know, he's, in addition to that, she actually gets pregnant. Now think about this for a second. There's a genetic anomaly that Henry carries. He got this woman, this incredible woman who has her own story that you can't quite pull yourself away from, but he gets her pregnant. And you don't think much about it. Oh, she's pregnant. Okay, great. Until she's eating by herself because he's off jumping. And she feels terrible all of a sudden. And she brings her hand up from her lap. It's full of blood. Yes. The fetus is a jumper.
It's a miscarriage.
You're not prepared. Are you? Were you prepared for that?
No, I wasn't prepared. And it's kind of, it's a little bit part of the squeamish part for me. I'm not. But it's a challenge for them, you know, in terms of conceiving.
Say the least.
And bringing forth.
It's going to kill her if it does stop, because I won't go into all the details of what happens inside of her when that baby jumps. But got to remember that in the early stages of pregnancy, the baby is very much physically a part of the woman. And so when the baby disappears physically, you know, there's going to be some blood. It's going to be messy. It's going to be bad. This is not a normal miscarriage. This is much more than a normal miscarriage. And there's only so many of these she's going to be able to handle before she either dies or, you know, they're going to have to do something to keep her from conceiving, or he's going to have to do something to keep from getting her pregnant.
Something he does do.
And he knows she wants his baby more than life itself. I mean, she really gets on a thing about this. Well, let's face it, if you've been married to a woman and you've had a child with her, you know what I'm talking about. But she has this on steroids. So she is really into it, and he knows she's going to hate him for it, but he gets a vasectomy. But here's the theme that keeps repeating throughout this movie that John and I talked about for about 2 hours yesterday. And that theme is, there's upsides to being a time traveler, and of course, there are downsides. Now, both characters, from time to time, do things they wouldn't ordinarily do as regards time travel in order to take advantage of some of the good stuff, because they have so much of the bad stuff. And so, you know, he does some pretty cool stuff. You know, he does a little manipulation with the lottery in order to get $5 million so that she can have the house of her dreams and have a studio in which to pursue her art, which can't get into now, but it takes a lot of space and equipment. So he does that for her. He's breaking a rule, one of his biggest rules, which is don't attract attention. You're already got to steal clothes, break into places, do all kinds of bad shit, defend yourself, because people are going to try and beat you up. You know, so he has to be able to run, jump, fight, break, pick locks, steal clothes, do all kinds of terrible stuff already. So don't do anything else, like win the lottery, which he could do any day of his life, or horse race, or go to Vegas. You know, he avoids all that, like the plague, but he does it one time for her. Now, likewise, she can't get pregnant now. She finds out he's had a vasectomy, and he hates her guts. She hates his guts, you know, and so that's a bad period of time. So what does she do? She gets a call in the middle of the night. She looks by her bedside. There's no Henry. She figures he jumped. She picks up the phone. And it's Henry. Please pick me up. I'm freezing my ass off. in a parking lot not that far away in Chicago. So, okay, she takes the car, but on her way down, she notices real-time Henry, which is how I'll refer to him now, is on the couch. He's in the doghouse. Oh. Now she goes out with a slight little smile on her face. Something's going on. She goes out the door, gets into her car, picks Henry up in the parking lot. She's got only one thing on her mind, and that is impregnation.
Jump his bones.
But she has to be careful, because the guy sleeping on the couch has already experienced what she's about to do with him. He has to do it very carefully in such a way that he doesn't suspect. Later on, he doesn't suspect. And she does it. And she gets pregnant.
Yes.
She knows this might be one of her last shots. So now, you know, they've got to deal with it. They've got to do something about it. And, you know, this is when they start finding Henry's doctor, the guy who tries to help him deal with his condition and understand, you know, and of course, how are you going to find a doctor to do that? And that's a whole nother story, but it's cool. And so in the end, what happens is there's this huge tightrope walking with this couple as she proceeds term with the baby. She does make it, you know, really far, but they studiously try to keep their expectations low and what have you. And they're both just walking on eggshells and, you know, what should we call the baby? And he doesn't even want to talk about it, you know, but she's in distress about it. So sure enough, what does he do? Time travels and ends up meeting his daughter.
Yeah, that was a sense of relief for him because he realized that
and
he's
me,
able to come
I was,
to term.
I was having a nervous breakdown watching the thing.
Yeah.
And I've seen it before. So, you know, I'm all knots and everything. And he sees this girl, this little girl who, by the way, had seen both of them before in another scene. And you kind of maybe suspect something's going on there, but there's a little girl who just smiles like the sun. Mm-hmm. And if you thought Rachel McAdams as a little girl was cute, their daughter is like what? 5 or 10x cuter.
Yeah.
And oh my God. And so in any case, she yells out, "Daddy," you know, and she sees him and he's just like, "What?" Because he's never time traveled and seen his daughter ever. But now he does. And wow, it's really a moment. And of course, when he comes back to real time and goes back into the bathroom where his wife is trying to find a name for the kid, he just says her name.
Mm-hmm.
And everything eases up.
Right. Yeah, it's sort of like as you approach the end of this movie, you are, you know, you have this tremendous event that they realized was more than a challenge to try to make to happen, and that is to have a child. And then as you know, you're heading towards the end of this movie, you're confronted with death. Unique aspect because, of course, you know, they're aware consciously, not they, but Henry knows his death is imminent. And she can tell based upon his reactions that she then becomes aware of how precious their remaining time together is going to be. And I you know, it's sort of like you would expect this to be a real downer, but it doesn't quite hit you as hard as a lot of movies where there's just the death, because this death is not normal.
No, this is not terms of tears. What is it? Terms of endurance or tears of endurance or whatever that movie is.
Yeah,
Deborah Winger.
Yeah, Deborah Winger movie. Jeff Daniels.
No, this is not like that. This is not like that.
Terms of
endurance.
They
don't let you break. Yeah, that's it. They don't let you fall apart.
No.
They keep buoying you up. And that little girl does a whole lot of
right.
it. And she's an exceptional time traveler, it turns out. She has a lot more control over it than Henry does. And she can really move around. And she has a bon vivant, a love of life, and that is just wonderful to see. And, you know, and the 4-year-old Alba is her name.
Mm.
Suddenly starts meeting the 10-year-old Alba and becoming friends with her. And that's her best friend. And so they're together a lot. And then the first time that Claire, the wife, the time traveler's wife, sees Alba, playing with this older girl. She says, who's that girl? And Henry goes, what girl? And he says, that's your daughter. And he goes, no, the older one. Yeah, that's your daughter. That's
the daughter, yeah. Yeah, whoa! So they realize their daughter is a time traveler, too. Yeah, I'll tell you what. The fact is that listening to us discuss this movie could sound pretty confusing, but believe me, the movie is not that confusing.
No.
And the emotion, like I said before, will carry you through. And off, and that's the means by which this will become, the story will be clear. I just got a couple of comments I want to make about this.
Sure, go for it, John.
One is that we've talked a lot about this movie being, a movie with a setting in Chicago. Well, if you live in Chicago and you're looking for things about Chicago in the movie, stop looking, because what they did is they used a knockoff Chicago called Toronto. No disrespect. I shouldn't have done that. Toronto people are very nice.
You meant to do it. It was on purpose. We talked about this.
Yeah.
I got really hung up with the
fact that is everything they mention it, the Vic Theater, even the Newberry Library inside it is a law library in Toronto. I've been to the Newberry Library probably 20 times at least. So that's the other piece that this kind of annoyed me to some extent. Just on the peripheral, I just kind of gave Jared, my brother, a hard time about it. The other thing is that this movie didn't get good. It had mixed reviews at best. I went to my favorite reviewer, and that's Roger Ebert. And here's what I found out. I found out that the if you go to IMDb and read the the reviews that are done by the people who watch it, that the reviews are incredibly good. I mean, you got 8, 10 being the highest, a lot of good ones. But you go to the movie critics, like Roger Ebert, you get 2 stars out of 4. And the reason is because the reviewers, for some reason, feel a need to talk to consider the logic of the movie. And they, I'm not saying that they miss it. I think it's more that they're professionals. That it's sort of like they're required to say, well, we don't want to look like idiots. We better talk about the fact that this movie doesn't, in some ways, make a lot of sense if you think about it too much, about logic.
Who's thinking when you're watching that movie?
Well, I begin to wonder. I think it's almost like their profession requires them to almost feel like a peer pressure. Well, am I going to be the one that's going to say how great this movie is? Well, somebody else is going to comment about, I think it's just intuitive.
Yeah.
It's not like they're thinking that way, but I think they're just kind of, their subconscious throws them that direction.
So, and they often watch the movie without an audience.
Yeah, that could make a difference too. Of course, I watched, here I am watching it, fortunately, the reason this movie came up is because it came up on TV, and I told my brother, I said, I'm going to mark this. I said, I'm going to make sure to see it. And that made a big difference for me to be able to see it, et cetera. So the other thing I like to comment about is the fact that then I think about, I don't think I've seen many of these time travel movies. And then I realized that I have. And guess the one that I just thought about is Shoeless Joe, Field of Dreams.
Yep. Yep. Absolutely.
So
huge component.
And that's a baseball movie too. So it's two birds with one stone.
That's excellent.
The time travel, and that's a really, really good one. And I think that's one the critics embrace for some reason. I don't know if they like baseball or what, but whatever. So I totally recommend it. I am not a science fiction guy. I'm not a time travel guy. Or at least I don't realize how much I'm into it. I enjoyed this movie a lot. So I totally recommend it.
And if you're a reader, read the book.
Yes.
Yeah.
I can't read say that about that because I didn't get it. I haven't had a chance to do that, but I am kind of attracted to it.
Yeah. I read the book before anyone even thought about making it into a movie. And, cover to cover. I don't think I stopped. Couldn't stop. And so I just loved the book. So when I heard they're making a movie out of it, you know how you have those feelings.
But I'll tell you, movies, there's one criticism this does not get in the reviews, and that is it doesn't get the typical response a reviewer might say, well, You gotta read the book in order to. The book is so much better than the movie. That is not a criticism of this movie.
Nor would I make that criticism either.
No, because the fact is that this movie, it'd be impossible to put it all. As Jerry's described the book, there's just so much to it that you got to kind of carve a piece out of it that makes it a sort of a unique thing.
My God, do you hear all that?
Yeah, is that another dumper on a motorcycle?
No, man. There's something going on this. I'm pretty far away from all that noise, but there are people doing something today, going up and down this road with motorcycles, and especially equipped
without
with no
mufflers.
So bad. So anyway, apologize for all the background noise, but hey, it's authentic.
All part of it.
We're in Austin. Yeah, it's all part of it. So yes, I'm sorry to interrupt. Pray continue.
No, that's fine. I mean that kind of takes my comments. That basically you don't have this issue about
you don't have to
book
read it.
Versus
no.
Film. You don't have to read the book. You don't. You can see the movie stands on its own without a doubt, and I think the critics treat it that way.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people like to read the book first, then do the movie. I would say don't do that. Just go ahead and watch the movie because you'll enjoy the book so much more because all the details that you might have been looking for after you thought about the movie for a while are in the book. They're there.
Okay.
Better explanation of the rules, all kinds of stuff. Why Henry can't look at a TV very long. Aren't you curious?
Yes.
Anyways, that's it. So, John, hey, great time.
Good one. Very good. Enjoy this a lot.
Me too. All right. So I will talk to you tomorrow.
Okay. Sounds good. Talk to you tomorrow.
Hey, oh, let's go. Hey, oh, let's go.